You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
A single mother, she's no husband to help her out, you know? It's understandable why she's saying, like, government, help me out.
Yes.
And I need to compete with men in the workplace because I need to raise this kid. You know, so you have all the economic problems, I think, follow the breakdown of the family. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me is destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on a fantastic lady. She is a friend of mine. She is the president of Live Action, and she is the host of the Lila Rose podcast. And this is, of course, Lila Rose. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Zuby. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself?
Good. Good to see you. It's been like 7 or 8 months, I think, and I don't know how many countries you've been in. I'm sure it's been a lot.
In that time, probably about 10.
Nice.
But I'm back here in California, and it's good to see you. Lila, I've done a brief intro there, but for people who are not familiar with you, please tell them a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So you mentioned my work, Live Action, and my podcast. I'm also a wife and a mom. I've got 2 boys, and we're expecting our third in, like, I don't know, 8 weeks, 7 weeks.
Amazing.
Here. Yeah, a little girl. So we're super pumped for that. And yeah, I mean, I'm sister, daughter, friend, you know, relationships are, my work is obviously what people see outward facing, but I'm super grateful for an amazing community and faith. So yeah.
Amazing. Tell me a little bit about your life story, family background growing up, and then how you got into the work that you do now.
Sure. So I'm from California. I'm from San Jose, California, basically the heart of Silicon Valley. And I grew up as one of 8 kids. Mm. And that already was kind of unusual because not many people are having that many kids, especially this was like the 90s, my parents having all these kids, evangelical background, and they also homeschooled us.
Okay.
So my dad was in tech, my mom was an educator. And so we had this really, it was just very exploratory upbringing. We learned Latin, we were really involved in learning music, and it was just very adventuresome. And during that time, my parents weren't really activists per se. I mean, certainly they're living counterculturally compared to most people, but I got involved in pro-life work after discovering more about different causes. I was really oriented towards admiring people that in history had given their life for big causes. And I loved Mother Teresa. Mm. I fell in love with the story of Joan of Arc and just these heroes that really inspired me to become want to be better. And so when I was a kid, I found out about abortion. My parents were very pro-life, obviously, 8 kids.
Yeah.
you know, people were like, what are you doing with all these kids? And they just loved children. They wanted to be open to life. But I found out about abortion, and it was by reading this activist handbook my parents had in their home that I don't even know that they had read. They just had tons of books because they're educators. There's a bookshelf like in every room in our home. Mm-hmm. And one of my things was to read every book. I just love to read. Homeschool, you school yourself. You read your own books, basically. So I found out about abortion, and I really was deeply moved when I discovered most abortions happen in the first trimester. I saw this image of a baby that had been a first trimester, 10-week-old little boy or girl. And you can see at 10 weeks, you can see the humanity of the baby.
Oh, for sure.
Because the heart's beating at 3.5 weeks. And you can see arms, legs, a face. And this baby had been torn apart by the most prevalent abortion in America, which at the time was a suction abortion, first trimester. And as a kid, I was looking and confronting this horror. And I wanted to understand it more. How is this happening? Why is this happening? Why is this legal? And this is happening at the time 3,000 times a day legally in the United States. And so it really gripped me that this is the human rights issue of our day. You know, I was really fascinated by history and all these other human rights abuses in American history and world history, and that this was a human rights abuse that was happening today that people were blind to or had fully accepted. And so that inspired me to start Live Action as a teenager, which was basically a youth education group. And I would go to other schools and churches, and we'd give presentations about fetal development, the risks of abortion, you know, the case for life. And that's just basically inspired this activist movement. And then I got to UCLA, my college, and started doing investigative reporting, and that's launched a national platform. And it's been just a adventure ever since, growing the pro-life movement globally.
How have you had the courage and the wherewithal to maintain that? Because it's one of those issues, and I don't even want to say it's one of those issues. I want to say it is the most touchy issue in our society, in our nations, in the socio-political, cultural discourse, regardless of someone's position on it. I just find that it's something people don't want to talk about, right? It's not a pleasant thing to talk about. I very much share your views for the most part on this. But even I myself, there's times and places I'm willing to have the conversation, and there's lots of times and places I'm just like, I just don't want to, even just for my own sanity, I'm just like, oh gosh, like I can't. It's so heavy.
It's heavy.
It's so heavy. You're talking life and death. It's just, people can get very nasty about it. It personally has impacted lots of people in different ways. And so people can get very touchy about it. It's one of those things that's just like, maybe we can talk about all these other things, but that one, let's just leave it. This is kind of how it is in the UK. In the US, it's a much bigger social, cultural, political conversation. In the UK, it's just sort of tacitly accepted. Let's just leave that. Yes, there is a pro-life movement, but it's kind of just like, okay, these are the laws. That's how it is. And no one talks about it. It would be weird for a politician in the UK to come out and speak on this subject. Whereas in the US, from both sides, it's a common part of the discourse. So from a personal level and a sanity level, I mean, how do you battle that day in, day out from your teenage years?
Yeah, it's very heavy. I wrote a book actually where I was a bit of a tell-all just about like the emotional, mental struggle of being involved in something so controversial and, you know, dealing with my own issues during the time. It's like, I'm not a perfect person. I've got my issues, my experiences. And, you know, one thing that has helped me a lot is remembering, I should say, that this is a fight where I'm not the victim. I'm an advocate. That's my job. And the victim are these children who don't have a voice and have zero legal status. And, you know, even late-term abortions, there's over 10,000 happening. That's just what's reported. 10,000 late-term abortions, babies that are pain-capable, can survive outside the womb in this country. Like, think about that for a minute. 10,000 infants being killed. And it's just so horrible to grapple with. But I remember that they're the ones I'm advocating for. They're the ones who have no voice and no legal status, and I want to be their voice. So that helps contextualize the problem and gives courage, because you're like, they need us. They need us to speak. And then also just looking at society at large. I mean, I know we've talked about like women, male, female relationships and all that world of stuff, which is a whole conversation we probably will get into at some point. But, you know, we've been told as women that abortion is this special portal to power, that if we just have the right to, as they call it, reproductive freedom or choice to kill a baby, basically, we will therefore be equalized, more equalized with men, more powerful, more successful. And it's just a total lie. It's a complete lie. And since that lie has been told, you know, sexual revolution, Roe v. Wade, 1973, and so many women believe it. I mean, like women that are very talented. I mean, I think about someone like even Taylor Swift right now, right? And when Roe v. Wade was overruled a year and a half ago, Taylor Swift, you know, retweets Michelle Obama's very pro-abortion. My heart's broken that women don't have this right anymore. What right are you talking about? You're not talking about a right to be successful or a right to work, or you're talking about a right to kill.
Yes.
Abortion is killing. There's no way around it. It's ending the life of a child intentionally.
It's not just a child. It's your child.
It's not just a child, it's your child. Exactly. It's your own flesh and blood, which makes it, you use the word heavy. Of course it's heavy. because it's personal at the most core fundamental level. And but that should make us rise up and say, we got to stop this and we got to change the narrative, the lies that are being told on this. So that as a woman, you know, that also just gives me courage to say, I can't tolerate this, that my sisters, other women are being are living the lie that our empowerment is by trampling on children, when our superpower as women is to be able to bring a life into the world. Men can't do that.
No.
Men, we need men for that. We really need men for that. You know, thank God for men. But we have been blessed with that. It's in our design. And to distort that design, to turn against it and destroy that gift of a life is an assault on ourselves as it is on the child. I mean, the child's the primary victim, but it's also against our dignity as women, as nurturers. So I think that also just gets me up and saying I have to stop. And I have kids now, and it's even more personal.
Yes.
It's like, these are children. They need advocates. And then I look contextually at like human societies over the last, you know, thousands of years. Infant sacrifice has been practiced.
Oh yeah, very common.
For millennia. And the Roman Empire, the Greco-Roman Empire, it was commonly practiced, not just as like a pagan ritual, but it was commonly practiced because children weren't seen as equal in value to adults. Mm-hmm. Your development or your vulnerability meant you had less rights. But that's not just, you know, that's not American, according to our own constitution, that we all as humans, regardless of our age, have the right to life. And that doesn't begin at birth. Mm-hmm. That begins at the beginning of one's life, which is fertilization. According to the science, human life comes into existence at fertilization. So all of that gives me courage.
Yeah. How much pushback do you get from men versus women on this issue? And do you find that the pushback is quite different? Because I would imagine there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people out there who would make the claim that you are anti-woman or you have internalized misogyny or you're some victim of the patriarchy or you're just a religious nut who, you know, is interested in other people's bodies and sex lives and all the usual garbage, which
you sound like my Twitter replies.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Which is extremely disingenuous, but this is how people like to frame, like to frame the issue. And I would imagine that as a woman espousing that position so strongly versus a man espousing that position, the pushback is actually a little bit different. You're going to get pushback, but the things people say are quite different.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because I do think men have a special, like pro-life men, when they speak out, they're like, you're a man, you have no right to speak. Yep. And then pro-life women speak out, you're a handmaid. You know, like we are like part of from the handmaiden's tale. Yeah. It's so funny. It's like we're mad at you for voicing your opinion. And so that makes you a handmaiden in the handmaid's tale. Like the handmaidens in the handmaid's tale weren't allowed to have opinions, right? Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the easy way for a pro-abortion advocate to shut down the conversation is to just say, you're brainwashed, I'm not going to engage rationally with you.
Yeah.
And they're shutting down a rational conversation. That's not us doing that. That's them doing that. Because when you engage the rational conversation, it leads to the logical place, which is human life begins at fertilization. It's always wrong to take a human life. That's the idea of human rights, like the first right being life.
Yeah.
And that's what abortion is designed to do. So therefore, abortion is a violation of human rights. But yeah, I mean, there's a ton of pushback. I did like Dr. Phil's show a year and a half ago or whatever. And the audience was basically all pro-abortion.
Of course.
And it was like, you have no empathy for women. You don't care about women. And have you heard the stories of women who talk about their pain and despair after they had this abortion? And every year on the anniversary of when that baby would have been born, they mourn the baby that they don't have now in their life, you know, because they were told this is good, I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. And now that baby's dead. Like, do you know their stories? Do you care about their stories?
I think people also forget that half of those babies, at least, probably a bit more than half, are female.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the greatest.
Those are the potential future women of the world.
They are the future. They are the future women of the world. And they're the greatest killer of girls in the world today is
sometimes intentionally even targeting because of sex.
Exactly. I mean, India and China particularly have tremendous demographic imbalances because of gendercide. I mean, The Economist had this cover saying that there are 100 million missing girls. This was like several years back, 100 million missing girls globally because of gendercide, killing babies in the womb via abortion just because they're girls. So it's a very real thing. But I think it's narrative. It's brainwashing. I mean, you know this. You talk about this all the time. Like there's brainwashing everywhere. And, you know, the sexual revolution brainwashing about you know, men and women need to compete, and women need to destroy their fertility in order to be like men, and all this stuff. You know, that is, I think, like this mind worm that has just distorted the views of so many people today. But the good news is there are huge pushbacks to that. I mean, that's Live Action's job, is constant education. You know, what I'm trying to do with my show, just constant education. And I do think many voices now are speaking out against it, including many women, strong women. And I think that's making a difference.
Yeah. What role do you think feminism has played in all this? Because I think from listening to conversations with you and listening to your podcast, I think you have a more positive view of feminism than I do. I think feminism is one of the greatest psyops in modern history. And I think it's been tragic on multiple levels when I think of a lot of the stuff, a lot of the things that women are complaining about these days. I'm like, well, all of this was directly or indirectly a long-term result of the same thing that people back then were advocating. But before I give my perspective, I'm curious to know what yours is.
Well, I think you might say that I'm more sympathetic to feminism because I understand sort of some of the goals of the early feminists and what some of their achievements, and I think that there's a lot of good there. But I think we're totally aligned on second wave feminism and like new age feminism today, which I think is a cancer.
Yeah.
So it depends on what the definition of feminism is. Because, I mean, you look at what the early feminists were trying to accomplish, and they weren't trying to accomplish, let's destroy the family unit, let's liberate ourselves sexually, let's destroy our babies. You know, they were actually mostly all pro-life, pro-marriage. They were trying to accomplish, let's ensure that, legally speaking, the worst excesses of men and the worst excesses of women, for that matter, there's laws that make sure that there is justice, basically. And I think that is a real... You know, and that's why they wanted to vote. That's why they wanted to ensure that they could own property, you know, get an education, things like that. Those things, I think, are inherently good things, but they can be used poorly, like any good right. Like any right can be used poorly. Mm-hmm. And women using those rights poorly doesn't mean that women shouldn't have those rights. Just like men using those rights poorly doesn't mean men shouldn't have those rights. It means we need a society that fosters virtue and character so that we as men and women can use our God-given rights and our state-protected rights well. And I'm talking about rights not to kill a baby. Obviously, that's not a right. I'm talking about like the right to vote, to work, to own property, to marry, things like that.
When do you think it went too far?
I think it went too far once you get someone like a Margaret Sanger in the 20s. So it went bad. I mean, you had this really great movement, like the suffragette movement. Early in the 20th century, you had some good stuff happening in the 19th century. But then you have like this kind of burgeoning... you know, sexual liberation stuff that started happening as well in the 20th century with people like Margaret Sanger, and then also a lot of eugenicists. A lot of this is like Nazi Germany, same time. You know, Margaret Sanger was actually pen pals with some of the eugenicists who were advising Hitler in Nazi Germany.
I didn't know that. Okay,
it's crazy. So this, the whole idea was captivating the pop, you know, the wealthy elites of, okay, we want to have a cleaner, you know, whiter race, basically. And Margaret Sanger was also looking at, you know, the conditions of the poor and, you know, New York, where she grew up. She grew up in this big family and they had not a lot of money and there was abuse. And so her solution was just get rid of kids, you know, have less kids. And then eugenics was captivating to her. And in that process, she also got involved in like sexual deviancy. And she was this crusader that founded Planned Parenthood, which is now the biggest abortion chain. And that mindset of, okay, let's deal with the problems we're facing today. It wasn't even about men versus women. It was about, let's deal with the kind of working man and the working woman's, you know, the poor's problems today by giving them contraception and by having them have less kids. And that's going to like lift them out of poverty. And contraception didn't lift anyone out of poverty. They were still just as poor once they got contraception or abortions. And instead it started to... the ideology started to kind of evolve into this thing of, okay, as women, we should control our fertility using these drugs that are actually shutting down our fertility. Mm-hmm. And now we can be as sexually promiscuous as men because we don't...
As the worst men.
As the worst men, exactly, exactly. Because, a noble man is not sexually promiscuous. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think the kind of technological advancement, as they saw it, of contraception sort of empowered and put on steroids these terrible sexual ideologies that really captivated, you know, that was kind of like the flappers of the 1920s and 30s. And then you get the sexual revolution, the hardcore movement, the free love movement saying, you know, we're going to practice deviancy. It doesn't matter. Monogamy is not important anymore. Fidelity is not important anymore. You get Alfred Kinsey, who's a sexologist who made up all these basically fake studies saying everyone's sexually deviant.
Oh, yeah.
Sexual deviancy
is
normal. Yeah, bestiality is normal. Having multiple partners when you're married is normal. We shouldn't like look down on these things. That's like repressive Christianity. Mm. So you see this like this sort of whole worldview blossom in the 20th century that is aided by the technology of things like contraception. And, you know, as more and more, you know, people are developing sort of these basically justifications for bad behavior, yeah. right? And then we get to today where feminism is now, you know, have sex as much as you want and sexual deviancy is fine. Abortion's great. And it's not even feminism anymore. You know, it's become this like wokeism, the LGBTism of now
it's all eating
men
itself.
Can be women. Yeah. I mean, it's eating itself alive because there's no logic to it.
You're supposed to simultaneously believe that men and women are vastly different and there's a patriarchy and discrimination, gender wage gap, all these things. So men and women are totally different, but also they're exactly the same and should have the exact same interests, aspirations to the point that there is complete equal outcomes in every dimension. Oh, but also there's social constructs right. and
it's not even real anyways.
And none of it is real anyway. Yeah. And any man who says he's a woman or vice versa is that thing. So you're supposed to simultaneously accept all these things in your brain. And I think this is a great source of mental illness.
I think you're exactly right.
Yeah.
And the other thing I didn't even mention about the 20th century was the rise of Marxism and the world wars and the violence. And I think you kind of had this perfect combustion of, you know, justifications for sexual deviancy with modern thought, like I am my own God and I can do what I want and I can follow my own urges and I shouldn't have to have consequences for that. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you have these, you know, ideas that the family unit and God don't matter. Marriage is just a construct and doesn't matter. And it's a perfect storm.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting because we're dealing with a modern day version of a very old problem. I've been this year. I started end of last year, but I'm reading the Bible again from front to back, and
awesome.
I'm currently sort of midway through the Old Testament. And I'm just like, these people are just doing the same. doing the same nonsense over and over and over and over again. Just the spirit of rebellion. It's like, look, here are the rules. This is the way you should do things.
This is like, the law of God and nature.
They're like, nope.
Yeah.
We'll do it our way. We'll veer off this way. Boom. You get punished. It goes back. Have another king. That king also is like, oh no, I want to do it this way. And it just happens quite literally 100+ times through these stories. So we now have new technology and we're in a different economic position and so on. But I think it's kind of fascinating how the human condition doesn't really change that much. It seems like we just go through these cycles of, let's say, conservatism and things are more hemmed in and there's more social codes and religious codes, familial codes and whatever. And then it sort of explodes. Mm-hmm. People are like, oh, no, this is boring. This is the wrong way. Let's reinvent the wheel, thinking they're the first to ever do this. And then they go off. It goes off the hinges. And then something brings it back to sanity. And then some smart person again decides, oh, actually, no, this is too restrictive. Mm-hmm. Let's throw off all the shackles in the name of freedom, liberty, liberation, whatever it is. And it goes crazy again, and it just seems to go in these cycles.
I mean, a couple things. I think you're right. There does seem to be cycles of renewal and then depravity and renewal and depravity.
Depravity, that's the word.
In our own individual lives, you know, as well as in like societies. I don't think we're doomed to the cycle. Mm. I don't think we're doomed to always the rise and the fall. I think that we are doomed to death. I mean, like we all will die, but we can always, there's always the opportunity to choose the good, even in the worst circumstances. And that's the hope, right? Of any civilization, that you can choose the good. You're not doomed to be destroyed. You can choose the good. Destroyed, I mean, in a spiritual sense. Mm-hmm. But then the second thing that what you're saying makes me think about is the Garden of Eden. And what happened in the Garden of Eden? You know, you had this beautiful, perfect picture of harmony between Adam and Eve, between the animals, between the created order. And then God is just like, don't try to be me, be you. don't eat from this tree.
Don't do that one thing.
Satan gets into the garden. They were supposed to tend the garden.
Yeah.
And Satan gets in there. So already there was like complacency. Mm-hmm. And Satan gets in there, tempts Eve. Adam's just like hanging out while Eve's getting tempted, you know, not doing his job as a leader because he was created to lead. And Eve, you know, Eve is created to lead in her own feminine way, but she's also obviously disobeying, listening to these lies. She takes the apple, she eats it, hands it over to Adam. He eats it. They disobey God. They want to be like God, even though they are made in the image of God. They already are like God, mm-hmm. but they didn't want to obey him. And then Adam starts blaming Eve. And, you know, Eve, I'm sure, would blame him right back.
Yeah.
And like, you left me alone. You let the serpent in. I mean, who knows the conversations they had, right? Mm-hmm. But I bet they look a lot like conversations of disharmony today. At the meta level between men and women and in personal relationships between men and women. So I think at the core, you know, back to the feminism conversation, I think there's a temptation to wave the finger at one group of the sexes and say, it's your fault. Mm-hmm. Men, it's your fault. Or men to say, women, it's your fault. It's feminism's fault. Yes, I agree. Modern and new age feminism, it is a lot of that ideology's fault.
I guess one of the reasons why in my perspective, in my lifetime, mm-hmm. feminism has never been a force of good. So if someone
As you
goes
see
back
it today.
To yeah, so if someone
of
goes
course.
Back, if someone goes
yeah.
back, I was not alive in the 1800s, yeah. right? So yeah. if someone's like, oh, you know, in the late 1800s, this and this happened under feminism, I'm like, for more than 100 years, as far as I'm concerned, this has been a destructive.
But do you think women should
force.
Be able to own property?
Yes.
And do you think women should be able to vote?
I think all human beings, all adult human beings, mm-hmm. regardless of their gender, race, ethnicity, whatever, the same laws, rules, standards should apply to all people. There might be, I'm sure someone can find some little case. Oh, well, you know, what if somebody's blind and they need this extra?
They've committed all these, crimes and
exactly.
they lost their
but
right or whatever.
Generally speaking, I mean, to me, that's not even sort of feminism or civil rights. That's just, look, all human beings being created equally under God. I recognize in some different societies, it took a long time for the law books to actually reflect that. But in terms of just human civil rights, yes, obviously on board with that.
But you go back 100 years ago, mm-hmm. Or a little over 100 years ago, and that wasn't the case, even in the United States, in the Western world. And that was, you know, that was those harms or mm-hmm. those sort of problems were solved by a movement that then was called feminism,
sure.
right? But today, I completely agree. What you see of feminism is this monster.
Yeah,
I mean,
like,
it is a monster.
It's like anti-racism or anti-fascism. I'm like, obviously I'm against fascism. Obviously I'm against racism.
I mean, another way to think about it is like, you know, obviously you think abolition of slavery is good, obviously.
It's like a given,
But today, the anti-racist movement of like Abram KXND or whatever is like, I mean, it's craziness, right?
Yes.
And so you can say I'm against that, but of course I'm not saying we shouldn't have had abolition.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
that's where I'm at with feminism. Mm. And I do think some people take too hard of a line where they act like, you know, the early movement and what it accomplished was somehow wrong. I mean, I see some people saying should women vote?
should women
work at all? Should women, you know, have the right to property? Like, you know, they're kind of revisiting those conversations, and which is fine. Have the debate. But it's like, you guys don't know. I mean, I don't think you know what you're talking about.
I also think that that's like 1% of the fraction of percent of people who are active on X or on social
or
media.
YouTube,
I think in the real...
They get a lot of clicks, though, because it's interesting stuff.
It
but,
does. I think in the real world, it's going to be well under 5% of people, probably under 1% of people who genuinely strongly hold that belief. I know those people exist, but it's a bit like, you know, this demon of, you know, the left always talking about white supremacy and mm-hmm. white supremacists. And I'm like, yes, I'm sure you can find of the 350 million people in America, I'm sure you could go to some places and you could find a handful of actual ones, but it's such a minor thing that the amount of hype and stress over this ideology is just almost not even worth discussing. If there was some huge mass movement of banning women from voting, then my opinion will change. But I'm like, yes, I can see. Okay, there's a couple accounts on Twitter who mm-hmm. are posting
but
that.
The reality is, historically, mass movements have always been started by that small fringe, small then seemingly fringe group. And mm-hmm. it's not like I'm afraid today that those, I guess, hardcore red pillars, I don't know, trad cons, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call them, are going to be successful. It's not like I don't think that that's like a concern that I personally have.
Yeah.
But it's more that in the kind of world of ideas mm-hmm. and in the discourse, you know, the national and international discourse about how should we then live together as human beings?
Yeah.
How should we build our civilizations? when I think, you know, poor arguments are presented, they do need a response.
Sure.
And then when we make other arguments about, like, you know, modern feminism and how horrible it is, which is a very important case to make because it still has so much influence. Mm-hmm. You know, again, women are aborting their babies, almost a million babies a year in the United States, right? So it's like, it's a horrible, horrible crisis. But we need to nuance properly to call, to define our terms, basically. I think that is an important part of the discourse and a part of the exercise of the conversation.
Yeah. Do you know what my... Man, I have so many beefs with feminism. But you know what perhaps is the one that I find sort of darkest and saddest? Mm. And this is, I'm sure there will be someone who thinks this is me being benevolently sexist. But I think it's that essentially it's been decided that societally, culturally, economically, politically, or whatever, the standard that women and girls should aspire to in everything is the male standard. So all of these things, the goal of them is for women to be more like men. Okay. So women have certain bodily functions, menstrual cycles, capacity to get pregnant, breastfeeding. It's like all of this stuff is a curse. And we need to use technology and medical interventions and all of these things down to killing your own child so that you can compete with men, right? Even when people talk about the quote-unquote gender pay gap, which everyone knows has been debunked for decades, but even that, even bringing that up, I'm like, why is the measure how much money you make? Mm-hmm. What about, I mean, do people not realize actually most fathers would like to have more free time and they'd like to spend more time with the children? It's like, what about time? What about who spends the money versus who earns it? Why is it just, you know, males compete on lots of different dimensions. How strong are you? How much money do you make? How much cool stuff? How much resources can you gather and whatever? Women generally compete in different ways, but it's just like, no, this male standard is the thing that you need to aspire towards. If a young woman is like, hey, actually, I want to get married and I want to have a lot of children. And those are kind of my metrics. And I want to raise great children and a family. Even non-feminists or people who wouldn't consider themselves feminists often still look like, wait, is that it? Or
look
is there
down on it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is what about a job? What about a career? What about all these other things? Or just little things people say, like when people say that stay-at-home mothers don't work, I laugh in their face.
I know. I hate that.
A woman will be like,
I'm
a stay-at-home mom of four kids. Yeah. And you're like, oh, so you don't work? And it's like,
what do you do?
Yeah.
Like, what do I do? I raise children.
Mm-hmm.
I serve my community. Like, I mean, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
But it means that in people's brains, they've just associated even the word work with working for some company, mm-hmm. having a boss, and earning
a paycheck.
A paycheck in that sense. Whereas work historically, that could mean going out and hunting or gathering or looking after your land, looking after your household. Work isn't just the thing that you do for money. So it seems that in our whole generation and younger ones and perhaps the generation mm-hmm. above us, there's just been this perversion of aspiration and it's this homogenization of the genders where you just don't really want men and women to exist as categories. This borders into the whole trans thing. And it's just this sort of gray mush of interchangeable cogs. I think the coolest thing about women is that they're not men. The greatest thing
for a man who's like looking for a woman, that's like the number one thing. You're not a man. That's the first step. You know.
So it's like, why are you the things that?
And I think it's great that men are not women. Like my husband is a man, and I'm so happy. He's a manly man. And it's just, I mean, then I was just thinking about Canada, like that crazy story about they sticking a tampon dispenser in the high school boys' bathroom.
Do you know
in
the
Canada.
First time I saw that? First time I saw that was the first time I came to California.
You saw a tampon dispenser
in 2019.
Oh my gosh.
I got invited to Facebook headquarters in 2019. First time I was ever in California. And I went to the men's bathroom and there were female hygiene products, okay, tampons, pads, all
because
that in the male bathroom.
Because it's not just like women trying to be like men. Then it comes women wanting men to be women.
Mm-hmm.
Or women like thinking we should give what women get to men.
Yes.
So it's all messed up. It's all upside down. It's all insanity. I think what you're saying though is such a good point, that the core of it is rejecting the category that there are men and there are women, and God made them that way. Natural law is very clear. That doesn't mean there aren't, you know, genetic deficiencies or aberrations that can happen, you know, like, well, I have two X's and a Y chromosome. Okay, but that's an aberration of the initial design of XYXX. And that doesn't mean you're less human or you're less valuable. It just means this is a genetic condition you have, right? Mm-hmm. And that's something, or you have this, you know, a mental health issue that you're struggling with about gender dysphoria and you need treatment and love and care, right? That doesn't mean you're less human or less valuable, but it also doesn't mean you were born in the wrong body. This is your body, and your body is always good. It's a good thing that you have the body you have. So, you know, that's the real body positive movement, right? that's the real body positive movement of saying embrace your sex.
Yes.
Embrace the way you're made. So, and I think the sexual differences are, you know, that's obviously the way continue humanity.
It's good. People complain about it. I'm like, this is good, guys. It's not by accident that half of the people are female and half of the people are male, because it means when you put that together, we have the full picture. There are things that I cannot do and I cannot experience, and I cannot propagate the species alone. A woman... There are things that a woman cannot do and is not capable of, and she also alone cannot perpetuate our species. It's not some accident that we're different. You just see it everywhere. I find, like, once you're attuned to it, you see it everywhere. Even when there's all these diversity conversations and equity conversations about, oh, look in this organization, 80% of the executives are male and only 20% are female. We need to fix this. I'm like, so why? What's wrong with that? What's fundamentally wrong with that? Is that reducing the performance of the company? Are you making less money from? Is there a discriminatory law saying a woman cannot be there?
You can make those distinctions based on people's height.
Of course.
Or their perceived attractiveness or their perceived strength. I mean, you can come up with so many categories for why you think people should have access to the boardroom or whatever, based not just on sex. So we're obsessed with sex, I think, to some degree.
Yeah, sex, race, and sexuality.
Yeah, sex, race, and sexuality. But here's the thing. What is the core difference between a man and a woman? A woman can be a mother only, and a man can be a father only. Intellectually, emotionally, there is a spectrum. You know, it's not like men are all smarter than women and women are all more emotionally intelligent than men. There's going to be some men who are very emotionally intelligent and some women who are super good at science. You know, so you're going to see this in the world of the sexes. But what you will never see is a man that can give birth to a baby and a woman that can impregnate a man. Like,
well,
you don't see that, you know?
That's the truth. Even when I check the emojis available on my phone.
But the point, you know, the point there is then, if that, it's like, well, how do we discover how to be fully a woman and fully, you know, fully alive as a woman and in our femininity, and men in our masculine, in their masculinity? And I think it comes back to the core of fatherhood and motherhood.
Yes.
And if you base your sort of identity, maybe you're not a father or mother biologically yet, maybe you never will be, but you're called as a mature adult to be a mother or a father-like figure to others and serve others in a society. I think if that becomes the core of how you see your masculinity or your femininity, it orders the whole thing of what is my strength for?
Yes.
What is my compassion for? What is my desire to nurture for? And then it's about other people and service. And then all these other questions about how to be a woman, how to be a man, competition, the kind of like a lot of them resolve themselves. And so that's my hope, is that if we can go back to those cores of celebrating what's unique about women and men and collaborating together to raise the next generation biologically and spiritually, as well as we urge each other on to greatness, you know, then we'll have a great, healthy society.
Yeah. I think the competitive angle rather than the cooperative angle has been so destructive over the past several decades. I think the idea that, I mean, I'm not a historian, but I think the idea that the notion that men and women are even supposed to compete in a lot of different dimensions, I think, is very new. If I look at most societies and I take a cursory glance at history, it seems like, yes, of course, there's some overlap. We're the same species. But there were not many domains where men
certainly
and women
not in
directly.
Sports.
No, definitely, definitely
you
not
know, the
sports.
Gladiator fights. You didn't typically have like the female gladiator get
no,
up there.
No, so. But it was always there are male domains, there are female domains. There's a little bit of crossover, but mm-hmm. it wasn't this competitive angle where it's like, okay, for your job, for your career, for this, for that, for status. You know, men would compete with men. Mm-hmm. for all these things, but men and women were not going directly head to head. And I think that this has created this weird, it's gone from beyond competitiveness to some type of animosity. And what's strange about it all is, I think in the modern Western world, I call it the obsession with exceptions. Mm. You see this in every social conversation. People are obsessed with exceptions. And
they make the rule out of the exception,
yes,
which you're not supposed to do.
Yes, there can be a 1% case, a 2% case, and all the conversation is about the 1% or 2% case instead of focusing on, okay, well, what is it like for 98% of the situations? This isn't everything. So mm-hmm. even when you're having discussions about the differences between men and women, everyone wants to bring up, oh, well, what about this super effeminate man who actually really wants to be a nurse and have his nails?
And I'm just like, so what? Let him be a nurse. Like, okay.
Exactly, right? Or the hypermasculine yeah. woman who wants, it's like, yes, we're aware these exceptions exist, but for the most part, what are most women like? What do most women aspire towards? What are most women's interests and so on? And similarly for men, but I think people get so hung up on the exceptions that the majority end up suffering because you're trying so hard to accommodate and bend over backwards to accommodate every single exception that you forget, oh, actually most people want this. Like most women actually like being women and doing woman stuff, and they don't actually want to compete in all these male domains. They don't want to be construction workers and rocket scientists and this and this. Can they be? Sure. There's no law saying you can't. And actually most
men... But you have
men,
to compete properly if you're going to try that.
Exactly.
Is the thing. Like you shouldn't
yes.
get a special access just because
the
you
numbers,
have a woman card, basically.
Yes. And of course, and as a result, the numbers are not magically going to work out to be 50-50.
Exactly.
Similarly with men, it's like actually men like to be in their masculine frame and they like to interact. Look, if I talk to a woman the exact same way I talk to a man, they don't really like it. If I enter, they don't like it. So I think the equality thing has been mixed up because equality means many different things. Mm-hmm. And so I can say, yes, all human beings are created equal under God and
I
should
mean,
have
it's
equal rights
treatment
and dignity.
Under the law, but it's not the promise of equal outcome. And I think that's the key, right? It's like, yes, we have you know, the same rights in terms of the right to vote, the right to work, the right to marry, whatever, the right to try to get the job, right? But you don't have the right to the job.
Yes.
And I think that's where we've gotten so off course today.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also think that people want to be treated fairly more than equally. If equally means exactly the same, no one actually does it. You do not treat, people will say, oh, I treat everybody equally. It's like, no, you don't. Nobody treats everybody. You don't treat strangers the same way you treat your friends. You don't treat your family the way, so you don't treat your own children the way you treat other children. You don't, everyone treats, we all treat each other actually quite unequally, but we treat each other fairly, right? If you were to treat everyone exactly the same, you probably would not survive very long because invite random strangers into your houses if they're family members. Of course not. But I think you can treat everybody fairly and reasonably. Mm-hmm. If I'm sitting down on a public transport and a pregnant woman comes in and I give up my seat for her, that's not equal because I wouldn't do that to a 20-year-old man. It's not equal, but I think it's fair and it makes sense. It's logical. If it's an old person who's struggling to stand up, like, hey, yeah, have my seat. But if it's another guy who looks like me, I'm like, I'm not giving you my seat. So it's not real equality. It's more like fairness. this is almost sounding like the equity argument. but I think there's something interesting there. I just think we get so hung up in some of these strange situations that sort of the common sense goes out of the window and we start ignoring what people actually desire and the way that they're wired and the way that we naturally interact with each other, again, in this desire to make everything so level and flat that everyone loses their individuality.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good point. And, you know, the laws are not perfect. Like, we try to have laws match the natural law, the moral law, to the degree that makes sense for a civilization. And we you know, there's certain universal human rights we know we have, but how do you apply that practically in law? I mean, that's the whole work of civil society, right? To figure that stuff out. And but if your principles are messed up when you're figuring that out, your conclusions are going to be wrong. And if your principle is that, you know, men and women, women, there need to be 50% women in the boardroom and 50% men, then yeah, your laws are going to be messed up, right? But if your principle instead is, hey, we should make sure that society is safe, that people can raise their families, there's rule of law, that people aren't killing and raping and stealing from each other, and we should make sure that people can be active in their community to help, you know, decide the outcomes through the voting process. And I mean, there's certain fundamentals we can agree on, then you can, I think, have a shot at creating something beautiful. So, you know, the other part of what you're getting at, I think, is actually too, just over bloated government, like having a government that's so, having too many laws, having too much regulation, having too much bureaucracy, and then the control that that can wield on people based on these passing ideologies that are broken, you know? So that's part of it. But another thing about what you're talking about makes me think about with the whole push to make men and women the same and compete and all of this is the whole sexual dimension. Because I think that, you know, obviously as a criticism of not just feminism, but a criticism of the sexual revolution, I mean, that's, I would say, argue just as bad, if not worse, than the whole push to get women in the boardroom. You know, the other dark underbelly of that is let's all go push to just, you know, push people into bed who are not married with each other, you know, married to each other. You know, you can just sleep with anyone you're not married to, and you can, you know, there don't need to be laws that govern our sexual behavior, and you shouldn't have consequences for your sexual behavior either, right? It's like the free love movement. I think that has, I mean, that's the reason 9 out of every 10 women who have abortions, they're single women. They're not married. You know, who's killing the babies? Couples that are not committed to each other.
Yes.
You know, why do we have so much proliferation of porn? Because people are not ordering their sexual appetites, right? The way, you know, towards a higher purpose, right? So all of that, that junk, I think, has just made even this whole thing about the, you know, economic warfare between men and women. Honestly, the sexual stuff, I think, is worse. And it, in a way, predates the economic warfare stuff.
Yeah.
Because we are not actually communing with each other at like a spiritual, biological level. So, of course, we're going to be at war economically. Like the single mother, she's no husband to help her out, you know? It's understandable why she's saying, like, government, help me out.
Yes.
And I need to compete with men in the workplace because I need to raise this kid, you know? So you have all the economic problems, I think, follow the breakdown of the family and the breakdown of sexual order.
Yeah. I find that in the modern day times, people are generally poor at connecting dots. And I think that people are afraid to even connect certain dots because there's such a desire to not judge anyone or not make anyone feel shame or even apply standards or whatever it is, because some standards are hard to live up to. Instead, people just avoid connecting any dots and they just want to band-aid everything.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If we look at pretty much every single social problem that exists in a country like the USA or the UK, for example, it is all connected to the family. It is, all of it. Whether you're talking about the drug overdose problem, or you're talking about school shooters, or you're talking about the crazy sexual mores, or you're talking about abortion, or you're talking about just all of it, it all comes back to families, parenting, community. A lot of it also comes back to faith, which, again, people are afraid to even bring into the discussion, because for us, we're happy to bring it into the discussion. But for people who don't believe in it or don't hold on to any religion in a strong way, they don't even want to consider the factor of, is perhaps some of this a result of us just straying away from God's laws and totally inventing our own when it comes to all of these things. Like sex, sex is a big deal. Sex makes babies, and it's supposed to. And by detaching that, especially in the 1960s with the invention of the pill and abortion and contraception and, you know, these things kind of becoming popularized and more mainstream, you've now created just a, it's like a nuclear level event when it comes to male and female dynamics and sexual behavior and family formation and attitudes towards marriage and all, like they're all connected. And then, of course, that has impacts on the economy and on the job market and on politics and all these things. And it's like people, I think people are afraid to connect the dots because it's really uncomfortable and it can lead to some not nice conclusions mm-hmm. when you kind of go up the tree a little bit and you're just like, or down the tree more like, and you're just thinking, okay, what's at the root of
rebellion against God?
Yeah, what's at the root of some of these things?
Because and the order of life, the order He created.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think that's where
which
we are.
Which is such an unpopular thing to say.
It's totally it's like unpopular to say all these things.
Rebellion against God, you know, zealot, Christian zealot. I mean, I remember. So I became Catholic in college. I was raised evangelical. I went through a period of time where I was like, I don't know, am I agnostic? Am I should I be Muslim? Should I be, you know, Buddhist? Like, what should my religion be? Because I was really trying to discover what.
If you were Muslim, you'd be Layla Rose.
Layla Rose. you know, what should I really believe? What is true? Who is God? Who am I? All of these big questions, you know? And anyways, in that process, I did a lot of study of history. Mm. And I love history. That's what I studied in college. And I love this historian, particularly a sociologist named Rodney Stark. And he did all of these, like, deep dives. He wrote multiple books about basically the history of Western civilization and how it shaped the way that what we take for granted, how we see men, women, family, human rights, these things. Because before Western civilization, post-Jesus Christ, the idea that we are created equal, that we are created, the idea that children have value, mm-hmm. the idea that women are equal in dignity to men. They're different, but they're equal in dignity. Mm-hmm. The idea that, you know, classism or your class in society shouldn't determine your destiny, meaning like the caste system, you're born as a slave, so you should always be a slave. You're born as a nobleman, you should always be a nobleman, that people can actually elevate themselves through using their will and mm-hmm. their talent. All of these concepts were pretty foreign to societies before the event of Jesus Christ and his radical teaching of the weak are valuable mm-hmm. and the strong should care about the weak.
Yes.
And in Jesus Christ, you know, he says there is no slave, there is no free, there is no even man or woman, that we are equal before God is what the teaching of the church is and God is. And this radical respect for human life, mm-hmm. you know, rejection of abortion, radical respect for marriage between one man and one woman for life. You know, if you divorce and remarry, that's adultery. I mean, these are the Christian teachings. These are all radical, you know,
it is.
In the Greco-Roman, you know, the kind of at the time beginning to crumble Roman Empire. And from those ideas, what we get today in terms of the good parts of equality, you know, not the bad equity, but the good parts of equality originate with Christian thought, mm-hmm. which, yes, there was some classical philosophy that Christian thought developed further. You know, I'm not rejecting what, you know, the offerings of Plato and Socrates, because there was good stuff in the classical tradition, but they really humanized it and brought this teaching, this radical teaching about the value of all human life, the equal value. And so that, you know, learning about that, I was like, wow, Christianity's onto something. You know, Christianity's Jesus Christ's teachings, separate from even the question of, is he God? And then I came to believe, of course he's God. Mm-hmm. But these are beautiful, good teachings that make for flourishing societies and flourishing individuals and families.
Yes.
And that was so, I mean, and then looking at the social data to back that up, like Rodney Stark did all the, you know, all the social data, historical review of how, you know, the rights of women and children changed, family structures changed, getting rid of gladiator fights. Now we're not like watching men kill each other for sport. You know, even
it's
the
just MMA now.
What's that?
It's just MMA now.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, but they're not supposed to kill each other, right? Like, I know. It's funny because I know some people, like, they're like, yeah, MMA is so cool. I'm like, watching two guys beat each other up, like, that's definitely the difference between men and women. I'm like, yeah. I'm not. That's like, I don't get the same thrill that some other people do. But thankfully, yeah, it's not to death, right? It's not supposed to be anyways. Yeah. But yeah, all of these things, these are Christian roots. They have Christian roots.
Yes.
And yes, does that mean Christians are all good? No. Does that mean there weren't Christians who did bad things? No. Does that mean like some Christians didn't torture other Christians? No. Like, of course you're going to see chaos among the people because people are broken. But overall, the trajectory of Western civilization has meant good things. The abolition of slavery, the rejection at large of infant sacrifice and abortion, although now we have it back, which is horrible, right? And so that is, that gives me so much, that context, I think, gives me so much gratitude for the Christian faith and for the faith.
Yes.
And also just hope that when people see the big picture and they see that the maximum opportunity for their flourishing, of course, eternally, you know, come heaven, we hope, right? But in this life too, is obedience to this moral law that is good. It's given to us to free us, not to shackle us, you know, free us to choose what is good. Then, you know, we can all be better off by following that path. And, you know, I've been on shows talking about stuff like this and they're like, you preachy Christian.
No, it's all good. Preach
away. You're so annoying. You're preachy Christian. But I'm like, well, I just want people to be happy. Like this is,
you know, I think it, there's so much.
Yeah.
There's joyful. I think there's so much there. And, you know, I think some of it is ignorance about history and just lack of thinking on many people's part. I think that people forget that much of the, many of these tenets are not intuitive. If someone adopts the view that we take you, say you take a totally secular evolutionary biologist viewpoint of the human species and that we are, so we are essentially just advanced apes on a spinning planet flying around a giant ball of fire. And our objective is to survive and reproduce like other species, like as if we're a jellyfish or we're ants or we're a mosquito, whatever the thing is, right? Just survival of the fittest. Then these Christian concepts are not intuitive. The idea that every person is created equal or worth equal dignity, that doesn't exist in the animal kingdom at all. That doesn't exist, especially if they're not within your family or your tribe. It's actually counterintuitive. Love your enemy. That's totally counterintuitive.
Or because, treat your enemy justly.
Yeah, because like, I mean, if the goal is survival, no. Why would you do that? And we're so unequal in reality. People have financially, appearance, height, physical strength. We've talked about the differences between the sexes, adults versus children, all of these things. We're actually a radically unequal species. You look at most species, they look pretty similar, right? Like I can't even differentiate. Look at a group of penguins. Like, I don't know who's who. Human beings, I think it's fascinating that we just look so different. There's no two, you're the only person who looks exactly the way you look in this world. And so we have so much diversity within our species. And I just think that, yeah, if you take that raw animalistic belief, yeah, and sure, someone can try to adopt some secular humanism, but I find secular humanism actually borrows a lot of ideas from Christianity it and does. Just takes the God part out. A lot of the tenets of it, I'm like, that is not an intuitive tenet. It is not intuitive that, oh, we're all created
well,
equally.
Well, it's interesting. You say it's not intuitive. It's intuitive. It is intuitive, I would say, in the sense that
it's written
in the heart by God. know, God who is love.
What I mean from an animalistic, from an animal perspective. And when you talk about things like monogamy, marriage, the way you treat children, again, you know, as a male of the species, it's like there's something animalistic within you. I mean, we're producing millions of sperm a day. If it's just about optimum animalistic mating strategy, the optimum strategy would just be, oh, okay, I will just go out and impregnate as, and this is what was done often historically. I mean, you read the Bible, King David, King Solomon, all the kings had harems of wives and concubines and whatever.
You probably have heard the argument that it's actually not best from an evolutionary standpoint for your average male to do that. Because then their offspring, they can't possibly care for all those offspring.
But if you're the king,
like
right?
If you're going to do the Andrew Tate style, like I'm going to become super rich and then I'm going to be Genghis Khan.
That's the thing that's fascinating about lots of these conversations because it does make sense. Like the different
arguments. In one sense.
Yes. In a sense, it makes sense.
According to the standard of my job is maximum power and influence in terms of my offspring and my the amount of control I can exert in a population.
Exactly.
And a
for
in a
generations.
Nation. Yeah.
Right. You know, Genghis Khan is like.
But to what end is the question, right? Exactly. And that's the spiritual question. Like, to what end? Is it to the end of, yes, maximum kingdom building on this earth when your kingdom will turn to dust and you will turn to dust?
And that's where the religious piece comes in.
Right.
And without, that's my point, is
and
that
also
without
tragedy
it,
strikes. I mean, that's the other piece that's, you know, you can't account for, no matter how many. No matter how much money one has and no matter how much physical strength one may have in one day, tragedy can strike the next. And that's the other, you know, well, I'm going to build, you know, bigger, stronger buildings and take the most supplements, you know, and like have a million children. So if half of them die, I have another half million, you know, like you can play that game and tragedy will still strike, sometimes really dramatically so. And so it's like we are much more frail as human beings than I think we realize.
Yeah.
And we can play the game of seeking power and authority on this earth. And we should, I think, seek in a sense, you know, to use our talents to serve, to have influence for good. You know, those are good things. But if it's like power and authority, it's a house of cards in the end on this earth.
For sure. What do you make of the discourse that's going on, particularly online now, just about gender dynamics, the traditional conservatives versus the red pill, the red pill as a whole, and some of its excesses? There's increasing conversation I've noticed over the last 2 years in particular, just about dating, relationships, marriage, you know, male, female sexuality, all of these things. I know you've been involved in some of these conversations. I think it's good that these convos are happening. I think it's messy and uncomfortable in a lot of people's perspective, but I think it's good that all the different sides are airing their grievances and their opinions and sharing their thoughts. I think long term this is a good thing. What's your overall take on it?
Well, it's funny because you mentioned, I think, did you say TradCon? Was that one of the categories?
Yeah, traditional
certainly
conservative.
There's red pill TradCon, and there's excesses in all of them. And like you would talk to a red pill guy who's like, I'm not that. That's not what I believe. You know, so there's like this variation even among these labels where they're not all the same. Because I know trad cons who think women shouldn't vote. Women who do any work beyond raising children is evil somehow, you know? So there's certain like excesses within the categories, but that's when I'm like, I'm Catholic. You know, like, I'm just like, you want to give me a label? Yeah. I don't even know I pick conservative, like just give me Catholic. And you know, the riches of the tradition of Catholic is you have these, like, you have Mother Teresa who's like, I'm going to be a celibate. I'm not going to marry. And I'm going to build this like spiritual order that has this global influence for good, you know? And I'm like, even the idea of a woman saying, I'm going to not be a man, I'm going to be a woman, but I'm not going to get married. I'm not, you know, subject to a husband. I'm going to be, Jesus Christ is my spouse. And I'm going to build this religious order like that, you know, in the back to the Roman Empire when like there were the virgin martyrs, like these women who said, I don't want to marry the emperor. I don't want to marry anyone. I don't want to be subservient to any man because I am first God's and I'm God's spouse. That was seen as like this radical feminist act, you know? So anyways, I mean, I think conversation is good, period. It's good to have conversations. I mean, obsessions, maybe like not if people get super into something down the rabbit hole, but there's so much disorder and there's so much division that needs to be set right. That conversation is the only way forward, I think. Personal conversations as well as these kind of meta conversations that are happening. I mean, I have seen in the TradCon space and the red pill space some like excesses where it's almost like they agree with each other weirdly.
There's a lot of agreement.
Yeah.
There should be.
Well, agree on necessarily good things.
I think there should be a lot of agreement, but the points of disagreement are major and key.
Well, I was thinking about like an excess I saw recently, which is kind of like women don't, shouldn't kind of have a voice, so to speak, unless they're like with the children or in the kitchen, you know, this kind of more radical view we were talking about, like repeal the 19th Amendment, okay, like, you know, that whole thing. And it's like the only difference then between in those conversations, it seems, between red pill and TradCon is the trads are saying, yes, we shouldn't cheat on our wives and Christ is king. And the red pill are saying we have multiple wives and Christ is not king, you know? So it's like, that's your difference, right? As opposed to the fuller picture of, where I think I would stand, which is that Christ is king. Don't cheat on your, you know, your spouse, man or woman. Mm-hmm. You know, women and men are both called to virtue. And we are different, but our differences have the most to do with motherhood versus fatherhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think all of these other things about how we show up in society and education and work, there's a lot of gray area and nuance there.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I think 50-50 corporate boardroom should be men and women. Obviously, I think that's insane. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't get a card ahead because you're a woman or a man in the workplace. You should just, you know, if you happen to be there, you do your best and, you know, let the chips fall.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think motherhood and fatherhood should be prioritized, whether it's biological or spiritual.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think people like to say, well, you're a feminist or you're an anti-feminist. I'm like, just depends how you want to define your terms.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the weaknesses that are coming from the, let's say, religious people or conservative people in some of the things that they're addressing or failing to address that have created so much room for, let's call it red pill type thinking to rise in popularity, particularly amongst men?
Well, I think I think we've gotten a little bit up into this on Twitter, Zuby, yeah. But I think part of it has to do with outcomes for men after mm-hmm. divorce or, you know, experienced outcomes that many men may have in the dating world where they feel like women get this kind of get out of jail free card when it comes to bad behavior and they're being held to this different standard. And mm-hmm. I think that's the complaint that I often see. And I can see to some degree why that is a real lived experience. You know, but then I see the other side too. This is the problem, right? There's always two sides to each story, right? The man who's saying, my wife, she just divorced me and, you know, took the kids and all of this. Like you talk to the wife and she says, I divorced him because he was abusing me. And he said, that wasn't abuse. And like it devolves from there, right? You mm-hmm. have this, like he said, she said conversation. So I'm not saying that in every divorce there's abuse. I'm not saying that obviously, but my point is these are very complex conversations, situations, and it's hard to paint with broad strokes like men have the short end of the stick versus women have the short end of the stick today. Mm. I think there's a lot of short sticks being passed around because of our total chaos in our moral order and in our ideology. Like we have so many broken ideologies everywhere. So I know that's like, sounds like maybe an overly nuanced answer, but I just think there's not like a simple, men have it tough and women don't.
Mm-hmm. It's not that simple. That's just an inverse of what the most radical feminists claim.
Yeah. But I mean, I do think there's cases where, you know, it is unfair that women, you know, are graduating. Like if a woman gets a job at like a investment firm or a law firm because she's a woman mm-hmm. and a man who is equally qualified was rejected because she fits the quota of male versus female, you know, that is a clear case where he was discriminated against. Mm-hmm. Right. So that is happening. You know, I know we were going to talk about, I mean, we should still talk about some point like divorce law and all of that. I am not an expert on family law. Mm-hmm. I'm not an attorney. I've talked to attorneys. I've known people who have gone through the family court system and the issues there. And I've heard legitimate complaints on both sides, mm-hmm. men and women's experiences about the problems with the family law system. So I don't know. I don't know if there's, I mean, what do you think I might be missing when it comes to the red pill concerns?
Yeah. Well, wow, this is a big conversation. I think that first of all,
and I don't know how we're doing on time, but
yeah, well, I think a lot of the, I think that on both sides of that convo, if you want to just mm-hmm. make it a binary split of, you know, trad con versus red pill type thinking, where there is a lot of overlap. I think that for many decades, the genuine concerns of boys and men have been largely overlooked or ignored. Perhaps because there's been such a feminist push my entire life. Mm-hmm. And I think that oftentimes you see this about racial conversations and other things as well, is I think people often forget that you can uplift a group without smashing down.
Totally.
Pushing down another group. So if the goal is, hey, we want to uplift or shine some type of spotlight on girls and men, I think that in my life, it's always been like that has to be at the detriment of men. We need to push men down, you know, whether this is narratives about toxic masculinity or just highlighting the worst things that men do or just not really caring about men's mental health, despite the statistics being what they are and so on around, you know, suicide, drug overdoses, all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, no, men have had it too good for too long. So we need to push them down and we need to lift up here. Mm-hmm. Kind of like with the racial narratives where it's like, oh, to uplift black people, right, we need to push down white people. We need to have all these narratives and terminology and whatever, and they need to feel this guilt and shame and whatever. And that's how we uplift black people. And I'm like, no, I think that's all garbage. And it's getting back into the frame where you're just creating unnecessary competition and animosity. So I think that because lots of those concerns have not been addressed.
By whom? Like, I think that's
by the legal system.
By the legal system, right?
Okay. So if you go back and think of,
because I mean, I think that's isolating that is okay. part of the solution, because it's like who is responsible for the solution that you seek? Because like from my vantage point in the way that I'm living and like even like the show that I do, like I just had on a psychiatrist to talk about the war on boys and like how a lot of what you're describing, separate from the family law system, but just like, you know, in the plastics in our water to the way that they are, you know, put in schools. Like I'm involved with a school project where to develop a school that's an all boys school and an all girls school to really meet the needs of the different genders, and boys learn differently than girls at large. Celebrate that
school system, education system. Again, because for a long time, boys have been kind of treated as kind of deficient girls. And
like first women were treated as deficient men. So they needed to be like men by destroying their fertility. And then it's like, let's make the boys like the girls. And it's just chaos.
Yes. So, you know, you're the mother of two young boys. It's not the same. They don't behave the same as girls their age.
We get together with my friend who has a daughter. Like, they are different. They are very different.
Yeah. I have five nieces and five nephews and, you know, between the ages of 0 and 17, and I've seen them all grow up. I'm the youngest in my family. So it wasn't until I became an uncle that I sort of saw the process of babies growing into children, into teenagers, and seeing that all, and the distinctions even categorically between my five nieces and five nephews and their behavior from day one is very different. So I think that that's been unaddressed for multiple decades. I think we're at the very early and messy stage of, like I said, these grievances being brought to light. I think all of this was sort of silent most of the time. And now the reason why so many men latch onto a lot of the red pill stuff is because it's like, oh, finally, these complaints and grievances, all these unearned things are actually being discussed in the open. Now, some of the prescriptions and conclusions, that's where I myself would be like, oh, okay, that's gone too far. Or actually, that's a really goofy idea. Or you know what? That's more destructive than it is constructive. But in terms of the analysis of some of the dynamics and just sharing that male perspective, because I think it's often forgotten. I was actually going to ask you a question about this, because I think it's often forgotten that men have fears and concerns and they're not voiced much. So I think a lot of people don't know really what is it that men generally are like afraid of, or what are their worries, what are their concerns, or whatever. Women have them too. But I think that they're brought to light more, and people are generally more aware of what those fears and considerations are, and there's been more accommodations to make that. But I think that the male side has kind of been has largely been lost in that conversation.
Well, I think part of that is men want to please women.
For sure.
And I think women largely want to please men too, but it looks different.
Know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
I want to please my husband.
I know you do. So, I think with the husband,
but you're meaning our society is training women to not want to do that.
Saying a woman should please her, just saying that sentence that a woman should even want, like you.
But it's still innate. I'm saying like you can brainwash over nature again and again, and nature still will poke out sometimes, like still want to be like, ah, it's still deep in me. And that's where, you know, I agree with what you're saying. I think, I think that there's a lot of grievances that need to be aired and need to be resolved. And like you said, it's like, how do we do that project of resolving this together?
And I think the mistake being made on the religious and conservative side is either just shaming men for even having those grievances, the sort of just, oh, just man up or just ignore it or just pretend like that. all you're doing is that's just giving. I'm like, as long as that is the response, expect this whole red pill thing that y'all keep complaining about to keep on rising, because that is not the, that's not the proper response to it. Or if it's just any type of, I just find that the responses are usually very flippant. Or there are things that
from
are
from like religious conservatives.
Yes, they're very flippant. Mm. I think there's a lot of what we call in the UK, I'm all right, Jack mentality, which is the mentality of like, oh, well, I'm married and I've got kids and I've done this and it's great. So everyone just do exactly what I did without recognizing, okay, like these, your situation is not the norm. Perhaps it should be, and perhaps it used to be, but the climate has just changed so much economically, social, you bring in social media, technologically, financially, like the situation is just very different. So if someone is just like, oh, the advice is just love Jesus and get married young, it's not even that's like bad idea, bad advice per se, but to just like sort of tell that to hundreds of millions of men out there who are coming from all of these different places. Some are people of faith, some are not. People have got all this different baggage and they've seen their own situations. We talked about this last time when I did your podcast about the fact, you know, we are both from big families.
That's a privilege.
Parents stay together. That's the anomaly.
It's the anomaly. Big,
you know, parents,
and parents married.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's
a privilege.
Not so long ago. If we rewind 80 years ago, that was the norm.
Yeah.
That was the norm and the other was the exception. Now this is the exception. And the norm is some type of breakdown or dysfunction. Like I know I've talked to people who, I mean, they're like my age. They've, within their family and friendship circles, they've almost never even seen a successful marriage. Mm-hmm. Like their dad, their parents, their uncle and aunts, their cousins, their all the neighborhood they grew up in, like none of it worked. So they are so jaded that the notion of like, oh, just get married and have kids. They like rolled their eyes. They're like, dude, like that doesn't even work. Like I've seen it.
And I think getting concrete's important. Like what, because every individual is going to have their own variation of struggles and background and, you know, challenges, right? And as well as their own opportunities and privileges and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
We're all different.
Of course.
At large, I think what you're saying is that, you know, the reality is it's hard to provide for a family as a man today and be the sole provider. Like a lot of women do have to work, do a side hustle at minimum. Many of them want to because they enjoy having this work, but many of them would rather not. So like there's the economic reality of it's hard to just get started.
Mm.
You know, so many Gen Zers don't think they could ever own a home. Even many millennials, you know, people aren't buying their first home till they're like 40. You know, this is a common experience. And men particularly who want to provide, you know, if they're seeing themselves as that masculine leader, that's so much harder for them. And these are economic issues that are in some ways connected, you could say, to DEI type stuff and everything. But there's also other, you know, you could say when we went off the gold standard, that's when we started, you know, divorcing from reality, our economic system, and then the debt. So you could, I mean, I'm not an economist, but you could kind of get into the nuance of why that is. And some of it you can say is feminism and DEI wokeism, and some of it is just other economic realities. But I think the core question I would have is, okay, what is the practical solution? Because it's one thing to wave a finger and be like, I hate these TradCon commentators. They drive me nuts. And it's like, don't listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't listen to Taylor Swift for advice. You know, like if you don't like it, like I don't listen to, you know, Nancy Pelosi for advice, like, you know, like political or social figures that don't align with my values. I'm not listening to them for advice. So don't listen to them for advice. Maybe what's annoying them is that they're not offering a full solution to what you're facing. And what you need is not just a personal solution for like Jordan Peterson style, like lift yourself up from your bootstraps and straighten up your back and make your bed.
Mm.
They're looking for legal solutions that they haven't seen accomplished yet. Mm. And that's its own question, right?
Yes.
Like, what are the legal problems? And so that would be my question, actually, because again, I'm no legal expert, but when it comes to family law, and I've heard both sides and I've seen issues on both sides. And so that would be my question. Like, what specifically in the legal system when it comes to family law, it needs to be changed so that men are not treated unfairly, as is the argument of my understanding of the red pill guy. Because I think that to isolate it really into like, where's the disagreement, you know?
Yeah, that's a big one.
I think that would probably be one of the biggest ones, right? Maybe another one would be like sexual ethics, like, you know, these women are getting off scot-free for being promiscuous and like celebrated for that, but men aren't. I don't know. I would be curious to isolate what's the...
It's quite a web. I mean, I know you wanted to talk about some of that on your podcast if we've got time. But before we get into that, I had a question I did want to ask you, and it is related to this. Mm-hmm. And this is, what do you, in your opinion, you know a lot of women out there. I'm sure you advise and give mm-hmm. you know forms of counsel to lots of women out there. But in your observation and conversations, what do you think is the greatest fear of modern day women? What's the greatest fear or concern as it pertains to all this stuff?
It's hard to say that there's one because there are many fears and concerns.
What comes up the most?
The one that first came to my mind, and this is more maybe a reflection of the kind of women that I speak to regularly, is the fear of being alone. Mm. And, you know, the fear of being, I think part of that's unloved, alone, not being able to build a life with someone, and you know, a man, hopefully, that they can be together with and have a beautiful relationship with, a marriage with. I think maybe part of that is, you know, fear of an abandonment. You can kind of dig deeper psychologically, and then that can manifest as a rejection of the masculine because I have been hurt, I've been abandoned, so I reject the masculine. I would say the fear of being alone.
That's interesting. What do you think the greatest fear for men is?
The first thing that came to mind is the fear of being taken for granted. Mm. And again, this is, again, might be a reflection of even the conversation we're having and the kind of men we're talking about that, you know, and the things that they're experiencing. But yeah, that's the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What do you think?
What do I think from the male perspective?
Yeah.
As it pertains to this conversation, I think there's two. Mm. Men are very afraid of investing in the wrong woman. Mm. And
that could be taken for granted too. I mean, it's connected to that maybe.
I think it's a bit different. I think it's as a man, if you're going to be a provider and a protector mm-hmm. and you're going to share your resources and mm-hmm. your time and your energy and be vulnerable with your emotions, then it's absolutely catastrophic to put that on the wrong woman. Mm-hmm. If it's the right woman, it totally makes sense. And that's how your family will grow and blossom and you'll have great children together and she'll raise them and sacrifices will be made on both sides and boom, that's all how it's supposed to work. But if you do make that investment and commitment and it goes south, I was going to say the other fear obviously is fear of divorce. Mm. Men are not afraid of marriage. You'll hear a lot of people say men are afraid of marriage. That's pretty uncommon. Men are afraid of divorce. And when they look at the statistics and so on,
that's interesting. Like, you're saying men are more afraid.
Men are afraid of divorce,
more
not of marriage.
Afraid of divorce.
Yeah, it's not the marriage that's scary at all. It's that thing of whether they're looking at the statistics or they're looking at anecdotes and they're like, oh my gosh, I've seen so many people go through this thing. Again, it could be a friend, it could be a brother, it could be a father, whatever. Like, I don't want to go through this machine. That's why a lot of the, not all, but lots of red pill guys' conclusion is just don't get married, right? Just avoid the whole thing. Don't take the risk. It's not the fear of, commitment or being with one woman or even being monogamous in many cases. It's just like, but what if it doesn't work? And if the odds of that, people differ on what the statistics are. You'll hear everything from 30% to 55%. But even if you go conservative, even the conservative numbers are like, ooh, like that's, that it's a scary proposition to a lot of people. So I think that is the sort of deep-seated fear that's going on there. It's not, I think people like to strawman it and be like, oh, these people just hate women or they're afraid of women or they're terrified of commitment or whatever. I'm sure there's some people who are just afraid of commitment, but it's not really that. It's more like, look, if I'm going to work hard and I'm going to earn this money and I'm going to invest this, I'm going to take this time, decades of my life and my work and my labor and all that, I'm going to like invest it. Then I can't then have that snatched away from me and, have my heart crushed in the process and all that. So I think for men, that is the not often voiced, like genuine, deep-seated fear that they have that's causing, en masse, cold feet.
Yeah.
I think that's really what's going on.
Like, divorce is cancer. It's like a social contagion. So if you're like close to divorce, and many of us have been close to divorce, like you and I were just talking about, we're so blessed that we have parents who aren't divorced, but many who have parents who were divorced, or they have friends who got divorced or whatever, and you see the chaos and the horror of it. Yeah, of course I can see that making someone all the more scared. I mean, I have heard a lot, like, from men, the fear of like, I can't provide in today's world. Like, you know, it's going to be, how can I be that man to can take care of a wife and wife and kids
today? That's so interesting. Cause I think, okay, maybe see, this is probably interesting as well. So the men I'm saying typically with this fear are men with means.
Right. And that's what I was going to say. Right? I think you're speaking to a particular subgroup.
Yeah. This is primarily men who either are
millionaires, you know, just those
guys. but you know, there's guys who are on track. Ambitious people, you know, people who are like, okay,
type A go-getters who are making it.
They might
already
even be in their early 20s.
They're afraid of being taken advantage of,
Yeah. Exactly. And they haven't even sort of made it yet, but they're on a trajectory through a traditional job or through entrepreneurship to, okay, by the time I'm 30 or 35, I'm going to be doing really well. That's the fear. So yeah, I guess that of course, there's also going to be guys who are just like, man, like I want to do this and I want to have, but it's just so hard now, whether it's the labor market, the job market, just the way the economy is, to even if you want to be that provider and have excess resources, it's harder to do now than it was in, I don't know, 1975.
Not impossible, but really hard.
Yeah, you've got to be a high earner.
Yeah.
Or you have to massively lower your expectations and expenses, which... Mm. Or maybe a combination of the two.
I mean, I think my sort of thought on that would be the fear is not to sort of delegitimize the fear and say, well, you know, you're silly for having a fear. Yeah. You know, obviously there are really bad women out there and there are really poorly behaving men out there. And, you know, I think obviously selecting a spouse is the second most important decision you will ever make in your life. The first being, do I choose to try to follow God or not? You know? So it is tremendously important. And I think many people haven't been given the formation or the tools to do a good job in that process. Mm-hmm. You know, the dating culture is crazy today.
It's wild.
The expectations of the dating culture and, like, you know, because of sex entering into the picture and sex being just a part of dating now, you have all of this extra complication of like emotion and psychology and unwanted pregnancy and all of this. So I think if we focus, and I think the focus should be on providing the tools for people to become the best they can be and select the best spouses they can, and then work to make the best marriage they can, because selecting the spouse, yes, that's a huge decision, but then you got to work on the marriage. Like, my husband and I, like, we're working every day on our marriage. It is the priority. Mm-hmm. And we are not perfect people, two imperfect people coming together, but the foundation of our relationship is shared values and it's shared trust. And, you know, if you don't have that with someone, then you're going to have, it's going to be a disaster. And you might still have that with someone and then they go crazy on you. Mm-hmm. Like, that does happen. That's much more rare though. Mm-hmm. You have a much better outcome of not getting divorced. This is for the men who are concerned about this. Yes. If you don't sleep with her before marriage and she doesn't sleep with you, like, you guys do not cohabitate. You guys don't sleep together. If you have shared values, if you get to know each other's families and friends, and it's not just some, like, you know, not shared basis that you're forming together, you know, you it's not just sexual attraction that brought you together or like a fling, but you really have those shared values. If you attend church together regularly, this doesn't mean you will be isolated from any harm in your life or hurt.
Sure.
It doesn't mean that it's impossible that your spouse won't betray you. Those things still happen. They could happen to any of us, right? Mm-hmm. But it does mean that you have maximized your chances of having a healthy and long-lasting marriage. Mm-hmm. And I think just looking at the social data that proves that, that would be my best advice. Be like, okay, here's how to maximize for it. And that doesn't, like, solve every problem, but these are some tools that can help.
Yeah. Well, I think people need to hear that because a lot of people do not have the tools. They don't have the tools. And sadly, they were not brought up in an environment and surrounded by people who demonstrated any type of positive example on that front. Quite the opposite in millions of cases. So I think that's where a lot of those conversations need to happen. I do think that from the, you know, the quote unquote trad con side, that the sort of just telling people to just well, just don't be a coward and do it anyway. I'm like, dude, that's so counterproductive. You have to address.
Well, it's like, do what?
You have
like,
to
do
address.
Do what anyway? Because
what I mean.
Just marry any random person? Like, no, don't do that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, that's the thing.
If she's a woman, she's hot-blooded, just marry her.
I'm like, no, that's not good advice, man. Like, you need to show people
but
how
I don't think those are serious. Like, people that are actually saying that, I mean, I don't know who we're talking about, actually. I haven't named any names, but
yeah,
I haven't, I mean, it's not like I'm like, just marry someone, like...
I've seen do you know what I think it is? I think that on all sides, most people think that most other people are sort of like them. So
right,
if
we talk from our experience.
Yes. So if you have someone who has grown up in a religious family and they're from like a very stable household and most of their friends are also fellow Christians and so on, and they're in those circles, then you that becomes the default. And people can kind of forget that there's this whole world of like hundreds of millions of people out there in this country alone who their experience and their circles and what they've seen and grown up with, like, it looks very, very different. Mm. So when you tell someone like that to just, oh, you know, just find a nice church going girl and get married at 21 like I did, it's like, well, I'm great that worked out for you, but just in this current climate, I'm not even, it's weird because it's not even like bad advice. It's just a little, it's just kind of tone deaf and can be very condescending to many people because they're just like, wait, like you're not addressing all of these different things. So I think that the people who have the tools and who have the role models and who are living in a certain way need to give advice. Like, I mean, as you've just done, there aren't like practical things of, okay, this is how you actually can do this. So it's cool to... I mean, if you're going to tell men to or encourage men to get married, it's like, okay, well, how about how do you find and vet a good potential wife? Like, where are you even looking? Guys are there like swiping on apps and whatever and, you know, going out to bars and this and that.
And what are you valuing in the woman?
Yeah.
Like, are you valuing, you know, these sort of like social standards of this like certain appearance of physical beauty or attractiveness, which again, you should be attracted
for
to
sure.
who you marry. Like that I will say pretty definitively, but you know, it's all about like, what are you valuing? What are you looking for?
And for women too, because women also don't know. Like I see all these complaints and I'm just like, no one has told you some like very just basic things about men and the way that we are and what we are looking for. And
oh, interesting.
What would,
meaning you think they're just totally checked out about...
They don't know. Like, again,
like, what's an example of that? I'm just curious.
What's an example? Yeah. What's an example is when women think...
I mean,
that,
I believe you, but I'm
a good example is the sort of idea that men are attracted to the exact same traits in women that women are attracted to in men.
Mm.
So... You know, a woman might be wanting
to... Oh, she's like, I'm wealthy. I have this great job.
Yeah, look at my degrees, look at my job, look at my accomplishments.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know, the whole men can't handle me. I'm like, men don't want to have to handle you. Right? No.
If handling you is marrying your career, if like that's marrying you.
Or just, you know, women tend to like men who are, you know, they're willing to take charge. They're more assertive. Mm-hmm. They're more, you know, they're leadership type personalities and so on. They can handle conflict a certain way. They're not afraid to put their foot. And so there are a lot of women who think, oh, the way I relate to men is by being either aggressive or just constantly disagreeable and fighting him on everything and not helping him, not cooperating, competing. Like you're supposed to be dating this man or in a relationship with this man and you're competing and you think that that's cute or something. And I will tell you from the male perspective, that is driving him nuts. Mm. He's already out there fighting the world and trying to battle the world to provide for you, his family, and so on. He doesn't want to then be battling.
He wants a safe place to fall.
Yeah, to be battling you as well. And
land.
It's just like, yeah.
And yeah. You know what I think about all of it comes down to, cause we're kind of operating the conversation that we're having. It's like about what's happening in these like voices on the internet, basically. Right. Like
it's real too.
The
tweet. These are real world conversations.
Of course it's real, but like a lot of it is like what the trad con is saying or what this person is saying, like just get married and have kids at 21, whatever. Right. Like, but you know, the, what people really need is they need mentors and they need guides and they need people in their personal life that can help them figure out the stuff that they've got to figure out. You know, I remember some of the best advice I ever got from a spiritual director as a very young woman was, you know, read the book of your life, of your childhood, you know, what was good about it that you want to emulate and have in your future when you have kids, if you have a family, you know, what was not good that you want to like resolve or heal from or fix in the future for your future family, you know, get those habits right now. And then what was missing, you know, what do you want to add that wasn't there? And just like doing that work, that personal work of identifying, you know, maybe I was raised in a divorced home. And so I have these like broken views of marriage and I want to heal that. Right. Because when I go into my marriage, you take yourself with you.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think a lot of these are things are solved by like mentorship, honestly, like finding men and women in real life that you want to be like, and that you can learn from. And that, I mean, in societies before modern American, this has always been the way, right? Like there's always been that kind of passing of the baton and like the coming of age rituals and like the passing of traditions and knowledge and formation. And we are so disjointed today. And so people are looking for it from online voices, which again can be good. Like you can learn from online voices. I've learned from online voices. We're bothering doing online stuff because we want to help learn ourselves and help other people, right? But you need at the end of the day, someone who can get to know you personally, because I will never know my audience individually, very personally. You can't do that either. We can like meet people, you know, but they need people who will accompany them in their journeys. And I think that is the ultimate solution to like finding that spouse and, you know, creating a beautiful marriage is having someone, a guide help you in the process.
Yes. Lila, always a pleasure speaking to you.
Thanks,
Where can
Zuby.
People find and follow you online?
Thank you. YouTube. I'm on YouTube, Lila Rose Podcast, Live Action's website, liveaction.org. And yeah,
awesome.
wherever you hear your podcast, I guess.
Always appreciate this
Thanks,
speaking
Zuby.
To you. Thanks for your time.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.